Ah, so it's good to be here. It's good to be here in person. And you might be wondering, why are me and Carrie up here together? We are going to do a little ceremony for VSAC after the meditation. And Carrie will explain what VSAC is, and then we'll do a little ceremony before we go into this evening's talk. And this evening's talk is going to be on tranquility, our favorite word in our householder life. I know you guys got plenty tranquility. You don't really want to talk about it yet again, but we'll talk a little bit about it. So I guess I should check to see if anyone's here for the first time, because they may be a little shocked at the way things are going. Oh, great. Well, you might be thinking, what is going on? Good. My name's actually Tuere Salah. I'm one of the guiding teachers, Carrie Peterson, also a guiding teacher. And we're going to have a talk tonight, do a little meditation, do a little ceremony, do a little Q&A. It's going to be nice. Yeah, my kind of evening. So we ended the sit a little early, so we have time to talk a little bit about VSAC and what it is, VSAC. And then I'll talk a little bit about, Carrie's going to talk about what it is, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the little ceremony we're going to do.
Hey, so welcome everybody. Welcome again. Good to see you all. With this microphone, I always feel like I should start belting out like a lounge tune or something, like a lounge singer. But this is good because VSAC is in many parts of Buddhist Asia the holiest day of the year, the holiest celebratory day of the year. So we celebrate it here. Technically, it's the 31st of May, so it's the full moon of May. But it's also meant to be contemplated, celebrated at the time around that full moon in May. So we thought we'd say a little bit about it tonight, introduce a ceremony, and then over the next few weeks, people can interact with the parts of the ceremony in their own way. So we'll have this kind of few week period where we can really take part in it. So as the holiest day, it's meant to commemorate the birth, the awakening or enlightenment, and the death of the historical Buddha. And how I think we're meant to kind of reflect on this is, first and foremost, remembering that the Buddha, especially in this tradition, his humanity is emphasized. He was a human being who was born, said he was born under a tree, became awakened under a tree, and died under a tree. Right? So connected with the natural world, surrounded by perhaps overbearing family members, and endured all of the same fragilities of a human body and human form that we have, and undertook this quest, this journey to understand his own heart and mind. So we're meant to reflect on this journey. We're invited to reflect on this journey Not just to pay reverence to a historical figure, but more importantly, or maybe equally importantly, to recognize that that potential is also alive and well and present in our very human lives right here, right now, in this time. So it's meant to remind us of that that sacred possibility. One moment in the Buddha's life that always stands out for me, there are many, but he lived a quite privileged life, as many of you probably know. He was protected from seeing a lot of things that were difficult by his parents, who wanted to keep him sheltered, wanted him to become a king. And at one point, he kind of escapes the castle walls to go searching to see what else is out there. And the kind of charioteer, person who's driving him, is there as he encounters, in a really stark way, a being who is sick, who's like doubled over in sickness, clearly really unwell, a being who's aging, who's hunched over and leathered and very, very old, obviously very old, and also a corpse. So in these moments of encountering all of these kind of fragilities or vulnerabilities of being human, he asks the charioteer, will this happen to me too? Will this happen to me too? Not having encountered this before, will this happen to me too? And the charioteer says, yes, yes, you too will experience this. You too will experience this. So there's this moment of kind of sobering recognition of, yes, this is the fate of this body, heart, mind as well. And instead of kind of collapsing in despair, it ignites his spiritual journey, his search. No problem. Anything can happen at any time, and it usually does, right? And the fourth, sometimes these are called heavenly messengers. The fourth messenger is someone who has ordained, so a monk who is following a different path. So these moments of coming up against the vulnerability and the reality of his human form is what promoted his, what really sparked his search in earnest. So I like to reflect on that because it's such a human moment of recognition, but also of inspiration and aspiration. And I think we can look at the figures of the Buddha that we see around or remember the Buddha as an image. And in a similar way, we can also say, like just like he was a human being, we can also say, I too have that potential. I too have that potential for awakening, for transformation, just like the Buddha. So it's really meant to evoke our deepest potentials and capacities. So I ran into Reed, just a very short quote before I pass to Tuari. She'll explain the ceremony and the way we can interact with it. But this quote is from Rabbi Alan Liu, who taught a lot of Jewish meditation and was also close with Norman Fisher, who was who visited here for many years. They were best friends. He's passed away now. And he says, leap into the unknown. Leap into the unfamiliar, the insecure, the vulnerable. That's really what meditation is. Transformation is not a leisure activity. It's not something that any sane person really does voluntarily. Stop responding to your fearful impulses. Gather yourself. Take your stand. Be still. Get outside the picture so that you can see the picture and see what's really going on. Stop responding to your fearful impulses. Gather yourself. Take your stand. Be still. Get outside the picture so that you can see the picture and see what's really going on. So Waysack is an opportunity to really reflect and remember and celebrate the sacred possibility that's here for us, and also to appreciate that we do have models and guides, human models and human guides. So it's very fortunate that we have this opportunity, and it's to be appreciated and celebrated. Mm-hmm. Celebrated. Okay.
So generally, the way Waysack is kind of celebrated all over the world. So millions and millions and millions and millions of Buddhists on Sunday, the 31st, is when it's usually celebrated, that full moon. And they will go to temples, and it's like they will have a day long. They devote their day to the temple, and they take their refuges and precepts, and then they sit and meditate, or people will do a lot of work around temples and help get it restored. And then there are tons of, like what we would think of around Christmas or Easter, that are very celebratory festivals and things like that. And so what is usually done is there's a bowl, or there's some kind of a pool with a Buddha. It's usually a baby Buddha, and it's in water. A lot of flowers, a lot of candles. And then you go and you say prayers. Sin metta, sin merit, share the merit, whatever goodness you have in your life, you share it with all beings everywhere. And so what we do every year at Seattle Insight for the month of May, and we're kind of a little late here, but for the month of May, we sit out this bowl of water with a Buddha in it, and have some flowers, and we'll have to take one of the candles here back. And it's supposed to represent our interconnection with the earth, the way the Buddha was connected. Like Carrie was saying, he was so interconnected with the earth. We're going to talk a little bit about that today, but this, the way we're going to do this ceremony is to have a chant that is going. And during that chant, over the course of the break, you're free to go back and pour water over the Buddha. And there's a little ladle back there. So you just pour the water over the Buddha, and you send metta to someone who might need metta, or you share the merits, whatever merit, whatever goodness you've received from the practice, you share it with all beings, specific beings, whatever is your heart's triggered. And the flowers that are connected to this represents the earth and the connection to the earth that we have. The fire from the candle, our pretend fire, but fire nonetheless, a representative of fire is the fire. So the candles represent fire. The water that's poured over the Buddha represents the water. And then your merit, your sharing of merit, your sharing of metta represents the wind that carries everything. And then all of that is held in this space of sacredness. So for those of you at home, we do this a little differently. We used to do this when we had COVID. So if you have a candle that you can light your candle, have some water, if you don't have flowers or anything like that, it's really okay. Whatever you want to get to represent earth, wind is your merit, your sharing of merit, water, fire, and so earth, wind, fire, and water, those four elements. And then the container you're going to have is sacred. So part of your process, for those of you at home, is going to be the getting up during this chant as it's going on and gathering your elements together. And then at some point you will pour the water over your Buddha, however that is. In fact, a friend of mine years ago told me that he was in his dorm, realized what day it was, and poured water over the word Buddha. That was his ceremony. So even if you don't have a Buddha, that's fine. Write the word Buddha down and pour water over the Buddha. It's the same thing. And so the whole of this ceremony, it'll be about 10 minutes. We're just going to take our time. You'll have about 10 minutes. The chant that we're going to chant, I'm going to give you the... it's one of the Kirtan chants, and so I'm going to give you the meanings of what we're going to say. It's A Gurue Name, and it's really this chant. The Gurue Name is I bow. I bow to wisdom, and this is A Gurue Name is I bow to the wisdom that has existed from the beginning of time. It was here before time began, and whatever that wisdom is, we're bowing to that wisdom. And then it's Jugar Gurue Name, which is I bow to this wisdom that has lasted through the ages. And Sat Gurue Name, which is I bow to true wisdom, whatever that is for you. And Suri Guru Dave Name, which is I bow to this great invisible and divine wisdom. So we can't see it. It's very sacred. We all know it's sacred. We don't know what that sacred is, but we know there's something sacred about the wisdom that the Buddha found. It is not like a self-help thing. Even if we try to make it that way, there is a sacredness about it. And so we're really bowing to that, whatever that sacred wisdom is. We can't see it, but we can feel the divinity within it. And so that's what this chant is saying. Basically, it's just saying we're bowing to this invisible wisdom that we all have access to, that we come and go with it. And that it has been here before us and it will remain here long after we're all gone. And especially if we keep messing up the planet, could be sooner rather than later, but that's a whole nother Dhamma talk. So we're just bowing to that wisdom that exists. All right. So we will, if we could lower the lights a little bit here, just doesn't have to go all the way down, but just lower them. And then I'll start this chant. And then you can take your break, and whenever you can go and just take some time to pour water over the Buddha and send blessings. Can you guys hear that online? Great. All right, so those of you at home, find your four elements, and we'll be back here in about 10 minutes. Thank you. Thank you, guys. I hope you at home felt like you were participating in this little ceremony, got your little stuff together. And you can, we all can, create a space in the house for the rest of the month that we can turn the lights up a little bit there. Create a space in the house that, you know, you can just send these prayers, send these this merit and metta all month. Rodney used to say that WESAC was like Christmas and Easter. It's like I think of it more like Passover and Ramadan. It's very sacred. It's not very there's a lot of festival, a lot of stuff like Easter and Christmas, but it's usually held in a very, very sacred way in Buddhist countries, Buddhist monasteries. It's really, I guess, like recommitting yourself to the Dhamma like we do in January. It's more like that. So we're going to talk a little bit about tranquility. And I just want to take a show of hands. How many of you think that tranquility is something that you get when you're on retreat, and otherwise it doesn't exist when I'm in my ordinary life? Can I just assume that that's where we're at in the room? This idea of talking about tranquility can be such a problem for householders, because once we hear that word, we kind of shut off any possibility that it can actually exist within our lives. And we have a way of thinking that tranquility can only come if the conditions around me are easy and smooth. So if the conditions around me are not easy and smooth, I can't really, not really, have any kind of tranquility. I can bear it, but there's no tranquility. And I think that comes from a misunderstanding of what this word tranquility, this calm, is pointing to in this whole sequence of transcendental dependent co-arising. So if we take a step back, we have some moment, we're just going to use the difficult moment, because it's hard to see the dukkha in good things happening, even though dukkha is in good things happening, because if you get too caught up in the good thing happening, when it goes away, you will be experiencing that dukkha. So it's inherent in good things. But it's very hard to practice seeing this word dukkha that's connected to suffering in good things. We really see it, though, in things that are difficult. So we just use these difficult moments. You have some moment where you're having some difficulty. Something is come to you you don't want, or something is leaving you and you wanted to stay. And so in that moment of difficulty, our impulsive, habitual response is to turn and try to fix that situation, meaning fix something external to me and get it resolved, whatever that is. And the better you are and the quicker you are at resolving your problems, the happier you think you're going to be. And so there's this automatic response. And the Buddha pointed to that being bewilderment, because you don't realize that you're just spinning your wheels every time you immediately turn towards fixing something. Instead, the idea is to turn towards this difficulty, which doesn't make any sense, but turn towards this difficulty and begin to grasp why it's there. What has happened? What convergence has happened in this moment that I am pushing against reality? Because that's what is causing the difficulty. Something has come to you that you don't want and you're pushing against that. Or something is leaving you, you want it to stay and you're pushing against that. And so this constant pushing against reality or grabbing some reality that doesn't exist, this is the nature of our mental torment that keeps us locked in. So that turning towards fixing it is, I think, bewilderment, because sometimes you will fix it. It will work out good. You did exactly what you needed to do and everybody agreed and then you got your way and it's like perfect. But the reality is that that is only setting you up for expecting your way the next time and the next time and the next time. And then you're going to start really struggling against this constantly trying to get your way, and it doesn't happen. So instead, this year-long theme that we're covering is teaching us, how do you turn towards something that's otherwise difficult? And in those early few months, we were talking about uplift. If you remember, faith and joy and this sense of rapture and just this whole moment is about lifting up our spirits with energy. You're actually turning towards this difficulty, not in this kind of we're gonna have a party way, but we're turning towards it with a level of sort of interest and brightened mind that you want to actually see what's going on. You want to see what is what's happening here. Where is this coming from? And there is, when we turn towards difficulties and we have this faith and this willingness to turn, there is something that can get triggered where our spirits are uplifted. It's sort of like, I guess you could equate it to hope can come, possibility, potentiality, all of that can begin to grow in the midst of some difficulty, right when you begin to turn towards it. But in that turning, we're not turning to find a solution. You know, like my niece, she had an anger problem worse than mine. I can't even imagine somebody with an anger problem worse than mine, but she did have an anger problem. She would lose it worse than me. And she used to always say, you know, I got anger management. And I'm like, no, you don't have anger management. That is the problem. He's like, you know, I have anger management. I'm like, no, you don't have anger management. So sometimes there's this kind of way that we actually can get excited about fixing the problem. And what we're actually trying to do is turn towards this difficulty with an uplifted spirit and settle down. And settle down kind of and be with it. Because that's where we're going to stay from now on until the end of the year. We're going to turn towards it. There's all this. We've spent the last four months talking about all this uplift, and now we're about to turn towards this settling into and steadying ourselves with it. So this tranquility is pointing to words like allowing. It's turning towards accepting. There's a kind of quality of metta, so caring about this. There's a quality to this tranquility that's supporting our ability to steady with it, not overcome it, not figure it all out, but steady with it. And that steadying with it is just as accessible for householders as it is on retreat. When we go on retreat and we begin to, I've always said that we have to talk about this transcendental co-arising, both from the retreat perspective or the practice perspective, and then our daily life perspective. So from this meditative perspective, we're actually building up enough energy to steady our attention into the present moment. And usually we are steadying our attention in the present moment with an anchor. Just, can we steady our attention with the breath or with sound or with the present moment itself? Can I just stay present? And we notice the mind gets pulled off, but we just keep this uplifted energy to come back and steady. And even when difficulty shows up, hindrances show up, we get sleepy, we get restless, we have all kinds of doubt, I don't know. And all of that wanting some pleasurable experience, and this is boring, I want something other than this. And all of that energy, we are trying to settle our minds down, to just let it be with it. We have to learn to do this. We have to learn to steady and be still and not fix it. We have to learn that above all else, because you'll never know the liberative capacity of impermanence if you don't get to this tranquility, if you don't get to this calming place where you steady yourself and just let it be here. Let's just see. If it's so bad, what is it? It's mostly just that it's unpleasant, and we have automatic systems in our human conditioning that says if something's unpleasant, it's dangerous, and we got to stop it, and we got to fix it right now. But you can override that automatic trigger. And if you can override that automatic trigger and settle yourself into the moment, you can begin to see something that is of wisdom, that's beyond this kind of reactive way. You know, this Buddha statue that we have behind us is very unusual. I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but when Tim saw it at the store, and then he sent me a picture, and we were like, that's the statue we wanted to have in here, because the pose that he is sitting in is called the royal ease. And it's like a meditative posture on one side, and he's got his foot down like he's ready to get up and respond on the other side. And it's this royal ease. Usually that is reserved for Kuan Yin. But if you notice, Kuan Yin, she's sitting in full meditation in her pose, their pose, really. So we kind of flip the switch, because Buddha is also the mudra that he's got on the right side. His right hand is the teaching mudra, and then on the left is the peaceful, steadying mudra. So this represents, to me, tranquility. This is what we're aiming to do. Okay, so this moment has come to me, and I may or may not be able to steady with this. I may or may not. You may or may not be able to just be with it. But this willingness to give yourself permission to just give it a try, to see if you can allow it, accept it to be here, and you're ready to respond if you need to, but you may not need to. It may just be unpleasant, and it rises and it passes. But you won't know that if you don't settle, if you don't take this energy to look at it and then settle that energy down. And that's where we're at here with this tranquility. Now, I want to be clear, this is happening in the midst of about a second. So the whole thing, the whole transcendental can take, you know, sometimes it can take months. Sometimes it could take, the whole retreat, like a month long. So by the time we get towards the end of the month long, people are really into the disenchantment and dispassion. But sometimes the whole process can take a couple of minutes where you have about to, you know, do something, react, overreact, you're about to, and somehow you feel that about to energy, and you're like, wait a minute, what is this? What is this? Settle down. And then we kind of rest back, settle, this tranquility begins to come in, and then we begin to see what's actually happening. And I think after the next one, I think, is samadhi, and then we begin to turn towards wisdom. We begin to turn towards being able to see what's actually going on and begin to pierce it apart. So if we don't have this period where we actually stop pushing, that's what this tranquility is. It is it's like the stillness when you're meditating. And that stillness doesn't mean there's no noise or there's nothing happening. It just means you stop pushing against that. And just for a moment, you steady with it. That is as accessible for a lay practitioner as samadhi is for a meditator. We are not trying to be in a tranquil environment. We are trying to have a degree of tranquility inside. And part of what I think cultivates this tranquility, part of how we begin to get tranquil, what feels like tranquility, is that every little moment that you give yourself a nanosecond, a second, a moment, just wait a moment, don't do anything, the more you give yourself that possibility to pause, to breathe, to take a moment, something begins to happen. You begin to notice what we otherwise don't notice. You begin to notice your own resilience to be with unpleasantness. That's what happens over the course of a meditation. If every time something unpleasant shows up, or we get caught in grasping for some pleasant thing that we want, we can spend the whole retreat trying to get it, and we may or may not even get it. You may spend the whole retreat trying to, get some pleasant state. And then 20 minutes, 30 minutes, 45 minutes later, you realize, yeah, that's not coming. It's not going to happen. And the bell rings. Or you spend the whole time kind of pushing against some sensation that you don't like. And we have all that anxiety that just tracks us. So that's all possible, that those things happen. But equally, there are times when there are these moments when we just let unpleasantness be unpleasant. We just let the wanting something different, you know, it's okay. I can let go of that. But let's just stay with what we have. We can have these moments where we can just let pleasant be pleasant, come and go, unpleasant be unpleasant, and actually get interested in the neutral. When that begins to happen, it strengthens our ability to remember that. And the more we strengthen our ability to remember that we can be with unpleasant and it's not the end of the world. We can be with pleasant and we can let it go. It's okay, because it will have something pleasurable come to our way at some point. It's not the end of all pleasant. It feels like it, but it's not. And gradually, what we begin to build, more and more, I'm beginning to recognize this as resilience is what it ultimately becomes. We become more and more resilient. And the more resilient we see ourselves as, Gil Scott-Heron said, yeah, they're not that far away from wisdom, though. You got to listen to them a bit, but Gil Fronstell says that we build confidence. That's what he said. It feels more and more and more. We feel more and more and more confident in trusting the Dhamma, trusting the process. That's what that tranquility is. We are trusting in the Dhamma. It's not just this kind of hopeful faith that we turn towards the difficulty with. We're actually feeling more and more confident and resilient in our abilities. So one of the ways that I have found really supports this tranquility and turning towards is keeping all of our difficulties in relationship with the elements. I mean, I have looked at earth, I have watched trees, and there's a gracefulness with trees, even flowers, like there's a hardiness with flowers, as delicate as they are. Daffodils can push up through snow and they're like hardy, but they're so bright and they're so pretty and they show up in the dead of winter. It's just that there's such a resolve that comes from earth. And the more you start looking at earth as a elemental nature, that we have the same properties that earth has. It has natural stillness. It has natural strength and capacity. We have those same capacities. And yet, earth can be very stark and stuck. It can get very hard and painful. But when I begin to look at all my difficulties from this framing of the elements, I can tell that something, I might feel stuck somewhere, but if I put some wind with it, then I can breathe into it a little bit stronger. Or sometimes it's too windy and I need to hold on to something like a tree, and so I can feel into the earth and steady myself. or sometimes the sometimes water can be loose and fluid. It's too much. It can be gluey and sticky. And sometimes it can flow and move right through. Sometimes rushing, and sometimes like a, you know, gentle stream. So when I started comparing all of my difficulties to the elements and begin to relate to how to steady myself with these elements, that helped me begin to access this thing called tranquility, even in the midst of thinking I'm having a heart attack. Another way, this final one, and then I'll see if there's any questions, but another way, I'm going to give you an example. Some of you might know this. I may have told it. I know I've told it before, but I used to have these panic attacks. They didn't come until I started practicing Dhamma. And then when I started practicing Dhamma, now I'm having panic attacks all the time. I'm just like, it took a while for me to understand that I had so much inner trauma that I had to let a lot of this excess trauma go. So I began to realize that if I was going to ever settle down, I was going to have to be with that restlessness. I was not going to find a solution that was going to fix this restlessness, because we keep thinking, what do I need to do in my practice that will make the restlessness go away, and then I won't have it? And that's the way it's supposed to be, right? No, it is the opposite of that. You got to allow that. That's the tranquility. Allow the restlessness to be there. And it's okay. It's just restlessness. And it rises and passes. It's not always here. And the more you have this calmer, tranquil kind of attitude around what is difficult, the less the mind will push against it. So I want to give you this example. There's a Starbucks. It used to be Starbucks. Now it's a pet store, I think, or a dog grooming place. But it used to be this huge Starbucks on Capitol Hill. And oh my God, it was packed all the time. There was always lines. And they had this one seat that would fit two people, and it was tucked in this corner of wall to ceiling, I mean, floor to ceiling windows. And you could sit right there at the edge of this kind of like busy street. And I came into Starbucks to meet my friend there, and that seat was available. So I put my stuff there. Now, careful here, because you can't put your stuff there and then go get coffee thinking I've secured my spot. Because people in that Starbucks will move your stuff and put it over here. And they would, unless your body is at that table, it's considered a free table. So that idea that you put your stuff down and relax and go get your coffee, no. You just have to sit there. So I don't want to lose the seat, and I'm sitting there, and then out of the blue, this panic begins to kind of come, and I'm like trying to calm myself down. Just breathe, Tori, just breathe. Okay, just breathe. And none of the breathing is helping. I'm getting more and more and more angst up because the place is packed. It's so loud. And it's so just massive, people moving all about, and my ADD mind is just really struggling. I want to get up and bolt out of this place, but I don't want to leave the seat because there will be no seats when I come back. So I'm just praying my friend hurry up and get here. And it was something about sitting there by myself, no tea, no coffee, nothing. Just sitting there. And I looked out the window and imagined it was 4 a.m. Like, what would happen if I was sitting here and it was 4 a.m.? 4 a.m., there would be nobody out there. It would still be a little dark. It's like a bewitching hour. It's all quiet. And I could, there's hardly any traffic. There's no people. It's just quiet and dark and just peaceful, serene. And so I just imagined and kept getting rid of the people, the cars, and I begin to sense into that Starbucks at 4 a.m. The chairs would be on top of the tables. The place would be quiet. There'd be no people in there. It would just be still and peaceful. And I could feel that space. This is the space element that I'm talking about. I could feel the space of this 4 a.m. And then gradually I started adding somebody coming into work. They flipped on the switch for the music and I could hear the music and the line starts lining up and there goes the little espresso machines and I could begin to hear all these people moving about talking. And I never lost the thread of 4 a.m. I never lost the thread of what it would be like at 4 a.m. So even now, when I get anxious, I always imagine wherever I'm sitting, what would it be like if it were 4 a.m.? If you could sit here and take a moment and think, this place, the lights would be gone. The people would be gone. There'd be nothing in here but space. And you'd be sitting in this place with space, and that space that would be here at 4 a.m., the darkness, it's all still here. Just because the light's on, just because there are people here, that doesn't mean it. The 4 a.m. space that's here doesn't exist anymore. It's just got lights, people, sound on top of it. And I begin to feel into space as a way to help me deal with the actual restlessness. Actually be tranquil and calm with this restlessness. Because the restlessness that I was feeling, the panic, anxiety, never left. But somehow getting interested in what it would be like at 4 a.m. in all this panic and noise took my energy from that restlessness and put it into something else. So I had this space to begin to hold that restlessness. This is what I think we're working towards, right? So we're working towards generating enough faith and interest in being with some difficulty, not fixing it, being with it, and then softening your energy as best you're able to settle down a little bit and just allow it to be. And then let's just see what happens for a little bit. I mean, thankfully, my friend showed up and I could go get my tea. And then she had to sit at the table and then she could go get hers. But it was sort of this, it was a thing that I found. This is what I think transcendental co-arising, that tranquility co-arose for me with the anxiety. With the anxiety and the difficulties. So I'm hoping you can see that I could have turned to try to fix it, leave the place, work on my breathing, try to get rid of the anxiety. And I turned towards how could I just settle in the midst of all that? And that skill, whatever that was in that moment that I learned, I have been using it for the rest of my life. I've used it ever since this happened way back in like 2007. And yet, I still, when I have these moments of panic, I just try to find what it would look like at 4 a.m. So it's not that that's going to work for you. But what I'm trying to encourage you is to begin to see that whatever you, when you start practicing with the difficulty, then finding something that will support you in relationship with it becomes doable, rather than this kind of just looking for a solution to get rid of it. So let's just sit quietly for a moment. We'll have these as the reflection, and then we'll see if there's any questions. Alrighty. Let's see if anybody has any comments. Doesn't have to necessarily be questions. Could just be a comment about the talk or what you think about tranquility. Yeah, Claire, thank you for jumping in here.
Well, that talk was so clarified for me. It was great. I'm grasping something different. Feels yes. Really good.
Good.
So my question, though, is when you talked about your anxiety, for me, it's depression. So what is the mechanism, you know, like if I'm feeling depressed for day after day after day, the only and I keep meditating, but I'm not really thinking clearly about go toward it or whatever. So the solution, you know, is to talk to the counselor who might say, take the antidepressants. So what is the mechanism within the Sangha or with our teachers, like when you're just kind of hung up and having a hard time and forgetting the tools?
Okay, let me just back up a moment. What I hear in what you're saying, so I got to check and see if this is what you're actually saying, but what I hear in what you're saying is a little bit of aversion. This is the problem here. A little bit of aversion, like I don't want this, and so I am trying to find some way away from it. That's what it sounds like. And I guess let me just see if that's what it sounds like.
Well, you know, that's probably probably what's happening at that moment. But in the big picture, I don't want to run from it. You know, I want to do a good practice, but I can't necessarily think that when I'm in the midst of it.
You're right. You can't necessarily, but There is a part of you in practice that can get more interested in what's happening in the moment. So it's more like it's sort of like if your depression is like my anxiety, I didn't like it and I wanted it. I didn't want that to come, but that aversion to it was the biggest problem because I kept, it's sort of, I don't know how to say it like this. I'm just going to say what I think in my heart here. We get very habituated with some of these mental places. So like if your therapist is saying taking the antidepressants, and you don't want to take the antidepressants, then there's a bit of an edge here because you are trying to make your mind have the energy level to keep itself from being depressed, but it's habitually becoming depressed. And it doesn't work like that. You sort of have to take the antidepressants to raise your chemical level up to a level where you can actually begin to work with the depression. You can't work with the depression if the energy is too low for the mind to generate enough energy to get interested. Do you see? So the antidepressant, yes, having taken antidepressants, but the antidepressants are to help lift the energy level up to a place where you then can work with, it's not going to take the depression totally away, but then you can work with whatever that diminished, that depressed energy is. You can work with whatever is happening with you around it. But you can't really, the thing I found with my depression was there was the clinical depression part, which is what I needed the antidepressants for. But then I had this habit energy of spinning into depression. And I couldn't actually get to that habit part until I was stabilized in the energy level that would give me the energy and the uplift to be able to look at the habit part. Do you see? So that's what I just would encourage you to think about with the therapist. How do I stabilize the medical part of this so you can then have the capacity to actually see some of the habits and nuances that's following you around the depression? But you won't be able to do that if you're not physically like stabilized energetically.
I don't want to take up too much of this of the time tonight, but yeah, but I think my question is more like if the depression lasts for like 2 weeks and, you know, I don't get into somebody to start a medication and then it lifts and then I can see the Buddhist way of how I want to deal with it. But it's just that I can't remember to do that.
That's okay. There's nothing wrong with not being able to remember. You can't remember because you're depressed. it's not really you, right? So it's sort of like, it's not us when we get lost in thought in the middle of a sit. You can set this intention. I'm going to stay with every breath. Not going to be getting lost in thought this time. I'm serious. And then, you know, 2 minutes in, you're like off on some story land, you know? It's just that the practice is not don't do that. The practice is keep coming back. So when you notice that the depression has lifted, then you come right back to where you were. And you're training your mind to remember to wake you up and come back.
Okay.
So if you get caught in, oh, I didn't do it before, I was gone for 2 weeks and I couldn't really do it. And if you get too caught in judging yourself, then you won't have the capacity during that lifting of the depression to turn towards the practice because you'll be too busy complaining about what was. Do you see? Yeah. So you just want to, you just recognize it's not you doing that. But your sincerity to turn towards the practice whenever you do have the energy to do it, that's all it requires. And you gotta have an upbeat energy that is enough. I mean, I could only do like a minute of being with anxiety for a long time because it was so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So that minute had to be enough. Shante David says, don't look down on small deeds because a tiny drop of water over time will make an ocean. So don't worry.
Thank
about
you.
It. Yeah. Yeah, in the back. And then I see your hand.
Tori, how would you explain the difference between tranquility, as you're talking about it, this concept, and equanimity?
I think equanimity is a kind of a balanced holding of something. But tranquility is the softening that allows, it's this allowing energy. It's actually a softening with, you may have a preference not to have this, and yet you're going to soften and allow it to be. So there's a kind of a quality of equanimity, I guess you could say, in that tranquility. But I think it's more metta. It's more of the kindness or compassion, the care around it. And equanimity is a bit more, it can be stabilizing. And in some respects, this is what practice is all about. I'm really telling you truly my opinion. And you got to really get that. So that hopefully my opinion will spark you to want to sense, can I access this tranquility through practicing with equanimity more so than I can practicing with kindness? And I can do it through kindness, but you might do it through equanimity, and then you can begin to access it. Yeah, good. There's a question down here. Oh, two. Right here.
It's interesting to hear you saying that when you were at the cafe, what helped you was to think of a different situation, like at 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to practice the staying, and I thought, you know, a few times I heard in the past you saying staying with the moment.
Yeah.
So one exercise I usually do in situations like this is to, like, let's say, for example, there's a kid screaming and I can't stand this and it's really annoying and I feel like leaving the place, but I have to wait for my friend. So it's kind of like, okay, let me listen to this. Really, like, pay attention to, stay focused with the kid screaming.
Yep.
And then it's like, you know what? It's not that bad. I can take this.
Yes.
I'm going to stay. And, you know, I kind of, the kid screaming starts fading away because I'm focusing on it and it becomes smaller and more distance and stuff. So it's interesting. So do we have both choices of trying to put ourselves in a different situation that is more calming to us, or?
I think what I wasn't trying to create a different situation. I was trying to create a present moment experience of peacefulness right here, right now. So it's not, that was how I could imagine that I couldn't imagine being peaceful in that place. It was too loud, too busy, too much. But I could imagine peacefulness existed in that place when it's 4 o'clock in the morning. So that's the same way you're watching or listening to the screaming child. You are listening, trying to settle your anxiety or your agitation aversion, and you're trying to settle that aversion down so that you can be with. And so you could hear it as two different things, but I was really trying to settle down my aversion and panic right here and find the peacefulness right here that is present. And so the 4 a.m. was just my way of finding it. But what I'm really trying to do is the same thing you're doing. It's the same thing of trying to be with this moment just as it is and find the peace that's already there, which is, it's already there. Even in the screaming child, like you say, it's not the peace, the agitation isn't coming from the screaming child. Mm-hmm. It's coming from your mind's fighting with that screaming child. Mm-hmm. And so that peace, just like you listen and then begin to hear, oh, it's not so bad, it's not so bad, I can do this. That's the same thing I was doing, is trying to find the peace that was present right then.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for this talk, Terry. I really appreciate it. And I feel like I'm approaching, or I have thoughts about this question that I'm going to ask, but I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about the difference between being with and allowing and settling in and withstanding.
Standing by?
No, withstanding, like tolerating. Yeah.
Yeah. I think withstanding, tolerating, that's more like aversion. Mm-hmm. That's more like resistance. That's my niece's, you know, I need anger management. Mm-hmm. You know, I have anger management. So it's more like I'm that sense of it, right? But I want you to hear that there's nothing wrong with the tolerating, the withstanding energy. As long as you're practicing and trying to sense into where is there a resistance here, even though I'm tolerating it, I really want it to go away, and I'm really waiting until that happens. And I'm thinking if I suck it up and take it, it'll eventually go away. That we have to feel that. We don't know that. You won't know that from my answer. You're going to know. Like in the moment when I was in the cafe, I had spent so much time trying to get rid of anxiety that by then I had a degree of wisdom that knew anxiety's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere, but a minute meditation, my minute moment of enlightenment wasn't going to help me in that situation, because if it didn't end in a minute, the only thing I could do is get up out of my seat, and I didn't want to. Got the best seat in the house. That rarely happened. I cannot give up that seat. So I had to stay there. And so I could stay there and bear it with this kind of withstanding it, you know, and tolerating it and all of that. I could have done that. But somehow I just tried to find a way to be peaceful in the midst of all of this. And that wanting to be peaceful, you got to let go of the aversion that you have to the moment. You have to let go of this kind of wishing it wasn't like this. And that softening around that wishing it wasn't like this, that's what's going to help you free yourself from this mental dukkha that's happening. Do you see? So it's sort of like if you feel yourself tolerating it, withstanding it, bearing it, you know, sucking it up and just, you know, taking it. And then there'll be times when you're not doing that. And you're the one that can tell when you're doing whichever one. I could begin to tell at some point that I was really asking questions to try to get teachers to give me the answer. And I kept getting the same answer. And I kept trying to ask it a different way to sound a little bit more wiser. But really, I just want you to tell me, what do I need to do as far? What does the Buddha say about getting rid of anxiety? And you know, all the answers would all be the same. Like, you got to bear it, you know, be with it, soften to it. And I just didn't really, I was more like withstanding. So that was like the first time I'm like going to soften and just let the whole thing be. How could I just stay here in the coffee shop? No more pushing, no more agitation. How could I just stay here? And gradually add all that noise, people, sounds, everything back in and let it be there. Not from anger, but because I could see the peacefulness was still there. You see? So you're just practicing with this. That is your practice. That is why we're in this month of tranquility, to get you inspired to see the difference between when you're just withstanding it and when you're actually cultivating peace with it.
Thank you. It's going to take some practice, but I'll work on it. Yeah. Thanks.
It does. It takes practice. That's okay. That's not, we're not trying to, there's no getting it right. You know, we're not trying to get it right. I'm just trying to encourage you to practice with it. That's it. And not think that if I'm not totally peaceful and got it easy, that there's something wrong with me and I'm not a good practitioner. No, you're a practitioner because you're willing to both notice when you're just withstanding and when you're not. And you're okay with the withstanding because sometimes that's the best we can do. And you're okay with, you know, taking a chance every now and then and seeing if you could bring in some settledness right there.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.